Today on ID the Future, we're happy to bring you another interview with Dr. Tom Woodward, host of the Universe Next Door syndicated radio broadcast. In conjunction with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture, Dr. Woodward regularly interviews CSC scientists and scholars on various aspects of the debate over Darwinian evolution and intelligent design.
ID the Future's gift to you. What a pleasure to settle into a holiday with a good book to read. Better than one book, of course, is two. Or how about 12 new books or DVDs? Starting on Black Friday, we'll have 12 days of discounts on Intelligent Design and Evolution Resources, with a new item specially discounted each day. Be sure to check evolutionnews.org for each day's item. That's 12 days of discounts at evolutionnews.org. Now back to ID the Future.
Welcome to the Universe Next Door. Today, our special guest is Dr. Paul Nelson. He is no newcomer to the discussion of intelligent design, evidence for design in the cosmos, and especially the various problems that Darwinian macroevolution is encountering, not just conceptually, but right there in the nitty-gritty of facts gathered from nature. Welcome back to the Universe Next Door, Dr. Paul Nelson.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you so much for taking time from your research and writing schedule. You have been so busy in through the years, so to say the mid-2000s and beyond that, of course, to the right to the very present, working on a number of research projects. And of course, you've taken time off to share your insights through the Illustra Media venue of those fantastic DVD documentaries. I'll bet it's been a lot of fun to work with Illustra Media.
Oh, it is incredible. And you know, they're working on a new film. The working title is Living Waters, about marine life. And I just returned from Southern California and filming with them out on a catamaran with dolphins and humpback whales. It's scheduled for release in July, so keep an eye out for that.
We will do that. And of course, they have come out with a great set of films, not only on the intelligent design topic, but butterflies and the metamorphosis concept, and also flight, the genius of birds. And you played a significant role as a scientific commentator in those documentaries. Thank you very much for your labors there.
I love working with them.
Right. Well, today we're going to be talking about a variety of topics that are really cutting edge. And I know that your work with Jonathan Wells, the two of you, of course, are very highly ranked, maybe that's not the right word to use, but esteemed and recognized colleagues working with other scientists who have done their homework in the area of the origin of life, the development, at least according to Darwin's theory, the development of species over time. And of course, the topic I'd like to jump in right away is this issue, or the idea of Humpty Dumpty, and what can be seen and what can be conceptualized about the origin of such a complex thing as even a bacterial cell. Explain to us how you got this idea as you worked on it with Jonathan Wells, and what have you really uncovered? What do you think you're finding through this way of thinking?
Well, I think everyone's familiar with the old nursery rhyme about Humpty Dumpty. And he's up on the wall, down he goes, and it's an irreversible process. In other words, the Humpty sitting on the wall, chatting away with the king's soldiers and so forth, that Humpty disappears once he hits the ground, and there's no getting him back. You know the rhyme. Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan was sitting one day thinking about origin of life research from a bottom-up perspective. That is, you, as researcher, try to generate nucleic acids like DNA or RNA or proteins or lipids, you know, get the parts together and climb your way up a ladder of bits and pieces as you assemble more and more parts until you achieve the living state. This would be sort of a recipe approach to life. You know, I give you X, Y, and Z in the right conditions, and you should be able to synthesize a cell. So Jonathan was thinking about that, and he said, you know, why not start with a cell? Just put everything in place that you would need. Take a bacterial cell. It's got everything there. It's alive. It's metabolizing. And prick it with a sterile needle in a sterile buffer, so that you've not cheated it anyway. Just disrupt the membrane in the cell wall, and you know, you kill the cell in doing that, but you've got all the parts. You've got all the hardware. You don't have to work for them. It's all there. All the genes, all the proteins, the molecular machines, everything is there, yet everybody knows both trained biologists and lay people, everybody knows that cell is never going to come back to life. And Jonathan was sitting and he thought, now that's profound. He said, that tells us something about the living state. That tells us something about nature that is very significant. Namely, the parts do not constitute the whole. A living cell represents something that cannot be captured by any bit or piece or even a total collection thereof. Now, here's what's so interesting about this. If you go into the Origin of Life literature over the past decade and a half, you will find leading evolutionary researchers who recognize this reality. If you got just a minute, let me just cite from one of them, David Deamer at University of California, Santa Cruz. In a paper in 1997, he realized this problem. He said, we could model the origin of life in the lab by gently disrupting a live bacterial culture, subjecting it to a sterilizing filtration step. So that is Paul saying, you kill the cell. No living cells are present, but entire bacterial genomes are available together with ribosomes, membranous vesicles, ATP, and everything else. What would happen? Nothing other than the slow, degradative reaction of hydrolysis. In other words, it's an irreversible arrow away from the living state. Once you disrupt it, you can't get it back. And Jonathan and I, we're actually going to do this experiment. Take a bacterial cell or a collection of cells in a sterile buffer, disrupt them, and then track what happens chemically. And what happens is the complex molecules that are present there, like the proteins and nucleic acids, start to break down. Water comes in, and for instance, with a protein, it hydrolyzes the bonds holding that protein together. And what happens is you head irreversibly towards elemental chemistry. Now, everyone knows that's what's going to happen. And so the Humpty Dumpty experiment says, really, the challenge is, what does it mean? What does it tell us about nature? And Jonathan and I are going to argue what it tells you is that if you want the living state at all, you have to come at it top down. In other words, you need a system of greater complexity, the right kind of cause, namely an intelligent cause, to bring about the living state, not from its parts, but as a whole. In other words, if you want to sell, you need a cell. What's interesting, one final comment, and then I'll shut up. There's a guy in North Carolina, an Origin of Life researcher named Jan Spitzer. He's actually trying to do this. And if you Google his name, you'll pull up a talk where at a NASA symposium where he said, let's try to revive dead bacteria. And I'm thinking, that's never, ever going to happen.
Good luck with that.
Yeah, but I admire his courage for attempting it.
With us today, Dr. Paul Nelson, working in coordinated research with the Discovery Institute and many other institutions in the same endeavor of intelligent design, lab level, and theoretical research. Dr. Paul Nelson, you received your graduate degree, your PhD, from the University of Chicago, the Harvard of the Midwest. What kind of reaction did you get as you worked your way through that PhD program and held ideas that many of the philosophers and biologists there would consider heretical?
Well, I'll tell you, I admire Chicago because they admitted me in 1985, knowing that I had the views that I did. One of my undergraduate advisors, without telling me, in his letter of recommendation, told Chicago, Paul is a creationist.
Wow.
And they still admitted me. Now, they didn't give me any money my first year. I had to really borrow a lot to get through that first year. But with my second year, on through all the way to the end of my dissertation, they gave me a full ride.
Wow.
So, really what they did is they looked me over, said, well, he's not totally crazy, and we can afford to spend some money on this kid. But I admire them for doing that, because at Chicago, my experience was my professors and my fellow graduate students valued the dialogue more than being right. Of course, everybody wants to be right. It's human nature. But what they really wanted was a good discussion. So my first year there, my advisor, who became like a second father to me, really, my PhD director told me, Paul, you're going to have to work a little harder than everybody else to master evolutionary theory. He said, that's not fair, but that's how the game is played. If you do that, he said, you'll be fine. Just be a good evolutionary biologist, be a good philosopher, and you can be as crazy as you want.
Well, doesn't that really agree with even the Discovery Institute's policy that we should not teach in the public schools less about evolution? We should teach more about it. In other words, understand the evolutionary framework, the neo-Darwinian theory, but understand all the results, all the data, all the evidence, including the flaws.
I couldn't agree more. The way to mastery of any science and the way to greater knowledge is not to have a superficial understanding of a theory, but really plunge into it, right into its nuts and bolts. And if you have that kind of intimate, deep understanding of the theory, then you're the master of the theory, and the theory doesn't master you.
Yeah. Well, I found, of course, that same parallel situation as I was studying Nietzsche at Princeton under the world's leading Nietzsche scholar, the late Walter Kaufmann.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun just, you know, sitting at his feet, so to speak, not necessarily imbibing his philosophy, but understanding the true picture of what Nietzsche was really saying. And then, from a Christian perspective, administering the proper, appropriate, gentle but firm critique.
It's very interesting to me in Stephen's great speech at the beginning of the book of Acts that he says Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians. You know the verse. He could have said Moses was educated in all that malarkey. Moses was educated in all that nonsense. No, there was genuine knowledge there to be acquired from the Egyptians, but Moses didn't let that set his worldview. So I tell students, if you go to a challenging university, learn as much as you can, but maintain your intellectual freedom.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, we are so privileged to have with us today Dr. Paul Nelson. He is working very closely with the Discovery Institute on a wide range of projects, and we are going to be hosting, as it were, on the venue of our own apologetics.org, a special slide, one of those large slides that greet you when you go on to apologetics.org that will feature, that is featuring right now, articles that have been penned by Dr. Paul Nelson on a wide range of topics, including what just happened at this fantastic intelligent design conference that took place in the country of Brazil. You'll be excited to follow along what Dr. Paul Nelson is saying about that, and we will be coming back and asking him about that conference and other developments in the front of intelligent design as it engages in dialogue with Darwinian evolution. I'm Tom Woodward, your host. We'll be right back on The Universe Next Door. Welcome back to The Universe Next Door, where today we are excited to have with us Dr. Paul Nelson. He is, as we said earlier, a graduate, a PhD recipient from the University of Chicago in the area of philosophy of biology. Boy, that's a realm that I would love to take time off and get my PhD in. Mine is just in the rhetoric of science, Paul, so but I enjoyed my program. I bet you enjoyed yours.
I loved it.
Yeah, well, it's a privilege again to have you with us. You are a recognizable voice and face at the Discovery Institute. You know, featured, of course, on a regular basis, writing articles, contributing to the scholarship there. And also, as we had mentioned, Lustre Media has drawn on your talents and your knowledge to feature you with many interviews and their fantastic documentaries. We recommend all of them. The original trilogy, of course, Unlocking the Mystery of Life, The Privileged Planet, which was more on cosmology. I think you took a breather on that. And then, but you came back with a powerful set of comments and a very strong analytical perspectives on Darwin's dilemma, on the Cambrian explosion. And of course, you contributed very crucially to the other two very powerful DVDs, the documentaries from Illustrious Media that came out more recently, which are Metamorphosis and Flight, The Genius of Birds. If you are interested in receiving one or even two of those DVDs, we'd be glad to send them to you at no charge. Just contact us at information@apologetics.org. Information@apologetics.org. We'll also include with that a little information on how to become a member of the C.S. Lewis Society and be involved in what we're doing. Well, Dr. Paul Nelson, you were leading us into a discussion of origin of life. Before we get into that, if you could just describe very briefly what happened in Brazil recently.
370 participants came together for the first National Intelligent Design Congress, was held in Campinas, which is about 90 minutes outside of Sao Paulo, big university town there. And the talks were first rate. I was a little bit at a disadvantage not knowing any Portuguese, but I could follow the pictures, let me put it that way. And of course, wonderful conversations with a range of young Brazilians. I'd say the average age was probably late 20s. So this is a very young, very motivated group. And what's happened really is the crystallization of an intelligent design research community there in Brazil, more or less independently of the American context. I was there to give one talk, but everybody else was Brazilian. And I loved it. So I'm writing up a report for the Discovery blog about my time there and their hopes for the future. And this group is growing rapidly. They have a Facebook page. And my experience has been, once you raise your head and say, you know what, this is too interesting for me not to talk about it publicly, other people with a similar interest will join, and then the group just kind of snowballs. Although I don't really think there are any snowballs in Sao Paulo.
Maybe.
It was pretty nice down there.
I can imagine. Well, that is very encouraging, and I know that you may have met Nedi de Almeida Filho.
Yes, Inesio. He was one of the original founders of the group. He told me something very funny. He said, in 1998, when this group sort of began, they couldn't have filled a VW van. He said, we just didn't have enough people. And of course, they need a fleet of buses now to handle
that. That's terrific. Well, the theory of intelligent design, how you can detect the action of an agency or an agent that has intelligence, is an idea whose time has come.
Yes.
And even the armies of the world cannot stop an idea like that. Well, today, again, with Dr. Paul Nelson by our side, we're going to be jumping down into something of a thought experiment. I might describe it that way, because as I heard Dr. Nelson describe it to me, I said, we need to jump there immediately. And that is how self-replicating RNA, the experiments that is to try to get a snippet of just one side of the DNA ladder. Just think of DNA zipped open. You take one side of it, the RNA with these little embedded letters. And of course, one of the RNA world theories of how life started is that little RNAs began to act both as carriers of information, but also they had catalyzing properties. They could sort of speed up chemical reactions and do work as if they were a protein with all of its intricate twisting folds. So the self-replicating RNA research has its own active community working on it. Dr. Paul Nelson, what do you see as you look at this research, but also consider something of the SCUBA, et cetera, conundrum?
Well, let me describe for your listeners, it is really a thought experiment, but I think it's a very helpful one. Here's the problem. The Origin of Life research community is trying to build a cell bottom up. Can't start with a whole cell. From their perspective, that would be magic. You got to start with its parts. And so they say, well, we can't start with a whole cell, so let's start with a single RNA that can make copies of itself, and then we can get some kind of Darwinian selection process running and gradually accrete more and more complexity. All right. An intelligent design perspective can lend help in that project, but only in the following way. Or let me put it this way. We can show them why that project really is ill-conceived. All right, so imagine you met somebody who had never been near an ocean, had never gone snorkeling, done any of that, and you said to that person, I can swim around the water. I can swim around in the water with my face down for 2 hours and never raise my face out of the water to take a breath. And they say, oh, baloney, you can't do that. You say, now, wait a minute, what would I need? And they think about it and they say, well, you'd need some way to get the air around to your mouth. You'd need to be able to cover your nose, you know, and so forth. And what would happen is they would sort of describe a snorkel kit. And of course, you can do that. You put a snorkel in your mouth, you put a mask on, you can swim around as long as you want until your back gets sunburned, right?
Right.
Now you tell them, all right, I can swim 30 feet down for 30 minutes, never come to the surface. I can be 30 feet below the surface and never come up for a breath. And they say, oh, baloney. And you say, now, wait a minute, think about it. What would I need? And they say, well, you would need to bring the air with you. And as they begin to describe more and more of what would be required from an engineering standpoint or basically biology standpoint, they would sketch out scuba gear. You need to bring that oxygen down with you, have some way of regulating it. Again, you need the mask and so forth. Then you say, look, I can go 5 miles down. way down in the depths of the ocean, like the Marianas Trench, you know, and stay down there for days. Now they're hip to what you're doing, and they say, okay, let me do this. And they'd say, you'd need a pressure hull to protect you from the overwhelming, crushing weight of that water. You'd need to bring a lot of air down with you. And they would begin to describe a deep sea submersible. So the point is, as you move away from normal biology for a human being, to the surface of the water, just below, 30 feet down, 5 miles down. As you go further and further down, you need to bring more and more equipment with you just to stay alive. All right, now let's make the transition to the origin of life. You got an origin of life researcher, he wants a self-replicating RNA. RNA is a very delicate molecule, easily destroyed by all kinds of chemical processes. So to build a self-replicating RNA, you would need to protect it in various ways. Even to form RNA at all, never mind the function of self-replication, just to get an RNA strand from its constituents is incredibly hard to do. It's never been done. So you'd need to have some way of synthesizing that RNA, which cells do normally with complex proteins. Biochemists do it with complex machinery. And as you describe for your origin of life researcher what he would need, he would see, if he thought about it carefully, that really what he needs is a whole cell or the functions represented by a whole cell. But there's no way he can get away from that. You take away some of those key functions, you won't have what you need. And there's a direct analogy in the two cases between our swimmer, our diver, our deep sea situation. Move away from the surface where normal biology is and go down where it's not present, and you need to bring normal biology with you if you want anything at all. What this tells us is there is a lower threshold of complexity below which life cannot exist. It's simply not there. You want life at all, you're going to have to satisfy that threshold of complexity. And I think this is only understandable from an intelligent design perspective where the living state did not arise bottom up from its parts, but was rather brought about into existence top down by an intelligence. And I think actually the origin of life community could steal a topic or steal a march, so to speak, on the abiogenesis guys and say, we can predict for you the features that you would need to see given what we know about real cell biology. Here, think about it. One final comment on this.
Sure.
Every day, all over this planet, in trillions and trillions of settings, cells are trying to be as simple as possible, right? One of the things that happens to cells is they jettison parts if they can get away with it. So mycoplasma, which is a bacterium that infects the human airway and genital tract, mycoplasma has jettisoned all the internal machinery it needs to make amino acids. It can get them from its normal environment, which is you provide them. All right? But it still needs them. It just doesn't have to make them for itself. So cells are trying every day all over this planet in trillions and trillions of different settings to be as simple as possible. And what you find is there is a certain irreducible set of components that every cell needs that it cannot do without, because below that line, you cease to have any kind of life. This is, I think, very profound. It has all kinds of implications for origin of life research.
And that's indeed what is the conundrum, the mystery, the enigma that is staring all these researchers and the chemical origin of life, abiogenesis, as you described it today. Well, Dr. Paul Nelson, would you consider joining us again next week to discuss at a deeper level what we're learning about the origin of life mystery?
I'd be happy to.
Thank you so much. Well, today it has been a joy to have one of the leading thinkers and analysts, researchers, in this area of biological origins, specifically the complexity that we see in modern species and even in so-called simple bacteria, which are fantastically complex. So thank you, Dr. Paul Nelson, and thank you for listening to The Universe Next Door. Be sure to catch us on the web at apologetics.org. That's apologetics.org. See you back here next week.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2014. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.